Lecture 15, Antichrist in the Post-Apocalyptic Age, Martin Luther King, Jr.
The functional argument about the apocalypse is clearly unsatisfactory. All far-reaching change, all expectation of change becomes apocalyptic as a result and is therefore discredited. Moreover, the functional argument we have seen derives from narrow political purposes and a very weak intellectual base, to say the least. Let us remind ourselves that all democracies fight crusades, and all democracies fight crusades for universal values. This is true of the American Revolution, it is true of the French Revolution, it is true of the wars that democratic societies want to imagine. No democracy, and certainly not the American democracy, is comfortable with tawdry little imperialist wars. How many Americans today, for example, remember our experience in the Philippines? No, that's not what Americans want to remember, and probably with good reason. How many Americans really remember the American incursion in the Nicaraguan Republic in 1915, or what Teddy Roosevelt did with Panama at the beginning of the century? Americans became unhappy with the war in Vietnam once it became clear that it wasn't an anti-communist crusade or couldn't be presented and made plausible as an anti-communist crusade. Americans are crusaders. Democrats are crusaders. That's built into what democracies are all about. And that's why the label apocalyptic is so empty in its meanings and so difficult in its politics. The American memory, the American public memory, is concerned about the Great Crusades. It's concerned about the Revolution. It's concerned about the campaign against slavery in the 19th century. It's concerned about World War I and World War II. And perhaps less happily, it is concerned about the crusade against godless communism. All cultures, in some sense, if they're democratic, can be called apocalyptic, and they should not. That's not the meaning of the word. We talked last time about how apocalypticism became so much a part of the tissues of American culture, even though we called the Soviet Union apocalyptic. It might be worth a moment to remember that in the 1960s there was a real effort to somehow undo that, to attack that kind of thinking, not apocalyptically, but to say that it was absurd. It was in this context that the radical anti-war movement gathered around the Pentagon, chanted, and claimed that they wanted to see the Pentagon levitate and float away. The people from California probably believed that that would actually happen. But the point of it is, you delegitimate this powerful ideology by trying to make it look silly. Some of you may well remember Arlo Guthrie's popular song, Alice's Restaurant. Pop songs last usually a grand total of 6 minutes. Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant went on for 18 minutes and was a bestseller. This is rare indeed. But the point of it was to suggest that traditional authority, traditional images were in fact absurd, and to encourage people to see beyond it. This is part of what happens with a kind of theater of the absurd resistance to the apocalypticism, or the bogus apocalypticism, when it becomes a part of culture. Something similar happened in Paris not so long ago in the campaign against AIDS and safe sex. They dropped, you may remember, a huge pink condom on the obelisk in Paris. Now, that was not something that Mitterrand really wanted to happen, but it dramatized and it took some of the moral posturing out for perhaps a more realistic approach to social problems. Now, having said this about the functional argument, what I want to say as well is that in America, nevertheless, even though it was a secular culture, biblicist imagery was a part of its rhetoric, a part of the way people spoke, and not just on the 4th of July, but at all times, as in no other country in the world. In this respect, America does differ from all other democracies. American political culture has thrived in general on the Bible and on the images of the apocalypse in particular. Eschatological metaphor guides American, not American policy, but the way Americans want to talk about policy, the way they want to talk about their now secular world. Secular people find it perfectly comfortable to use such language. We can think, for example, of one such individual in the 19th century, a very unorthodox man, in some ways a very odd man in the context of the 19th century, the great writer Herman Melville. Herman Melville said, "We Americans are the peculiar chosen people, the Israel of our time. We bear the ark of the liberties of the world." A fairly full statement. All democracies fight crusades, but American crusades are Armageddon. If we ask ourselves, what are the three most remembered pieces of political prose in the history of the United States, name the top three, I would be willing to bet in any class, in any town, in any venue in the United States, these three would be named, almost without exception. Of the three, two have a specifically apocalyptic tone. One does not. The first document I would suggest in this case would be the Declaration of Independence. That is a deist document. That is a document from the 18th century. That is, at least in time, the furthest away from us. And it is not apocalyptic. The second document I would propose, and I'm willing to bet a lot of Americans would agree with me, and indeed would suggest it without any prompting from me, is the Gettysburg Address in the 19th century. And that is an apocalyptic document. That is a document that uses imagery out of the apocalyptic experience that America has had. For my third document, I don't think it's going to be controversial, and I think at the same time, all sorts of people would instinctively think of it. If we would say, what is the most famous piece of American prose since 1945, the answer I submit is Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech of 1963. And that, let me tell you, is apocalyptic in its imagery. That speaks with both an apocalyptic voice and a secular voice. All three of these, I want to suggest to you, are far better remembered than Washington's inaugural address, famous and worthy as it is, far better remembered than the other speeches of Lincoln or all their masterpieces of prose. They're far better remembered even than JFK's inaugural address, ask not what you can do for your country, but for yourself, but ask what you can do for your country. You see, the speech is so unknown that I actually can't say it right. The great speeches of FDR and Woodrow Wilson, the fireside chats, none of these are in the same league. To list these writings is to remember that the apocalyptic impulse and evangelical movements need not be reactionary. Today, when we associate our thinking with apocalypticism, we think of what? We think of repression. We think of conservatism. We think of authoritarian anti-intellectualism. We think of what? Pat Robertson. We think of the Opus Dei movement amongst the Catholics. Jose Maria Escriva, who will surely be the fastest saint in the history of the Catholic Church. Or we think of Our Lady of Fatima, holding back the arm of Christ ready to strike. All enormously conservative movements. And just to be Jewish and to cover the full spectrum, who else do we think of? We think of Rabbi Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who came from Brooklyn, and for a brief moment I thought maybe he was the Messiah. Well, he had two massive heart attacks at 92 and kept plugging along. I thought, my goodness, maybe that was a sign that he was. All of these people are enormously conservative. All of them generally think in terms of the apocalypse, in terms of the millennium or the Messiah. But the apocalyptic impulse, I want to suggest, and the pieces of literature I've just listed for you hopefully will suggest as well, that the apocalypse and evangelicalism can be progressive every bit as much as reactionary. And that, of course, has been the case as late as the 1960s, as late as recently as 25 years ago. Martin Luther King is squarely in the evangelical tradition. Theologically, he has been described as neo-Orthodox. He was heavily influenced by theologians like Boozer and Niebuhr, but his speeches and writings spoke to many in an apocalyptic register. Apocalypticism, real apocalypticism, not functional apocalypticism. Let's first look at where this imagery, and to some extent these literal beliefs, informed a powerful movement within the United States, indeed a movement that convulsed the United States. I'm thinking of the anti-slavery campaign of the 19th century. Hostility to slavery, let me remind you, is modern and recent. It is not ancient. It is not a part, that is to say, anti-slavery is not a part of any ancient Western tradition. Nor, so far as I am aware, has any other civilization in the world opposed it. Slavery has been practiced in a variety of forms through a variety of systems throughout the world. The West, and so far as I'm aware, the West alone has opposed it, and that opposition is apocalyptic in its origins. Christianity itself had no problem with it. The medieval church had no problem with it. Christian moralists saw slavery as legitimate in a fallen world where men had to live through a veil of tears. The main concern of Christian moralists was how to treat your slaves, to make sure that they got good Christian doctrine, that they understood what the church was about, and that was all that was necessary. The gradual decline of slavery in favor of serfdom and other forms of unfreedom was purely economic in the Middle Ages. There was no crusade against slavery at that time. There has indeed been a continuous tradition of chattel slavery throughout Western Europe, outstandingly in Iberia, coming straight from antiquity onwards. Whether Muslims from Iberia or North Africa, the Middle East, or Christians, that is to say Orthodox Christians, not Catholic Christians, from the Black Sea, slavery has been integral to Latin Christendom. Thomistic naturalism does not confute slavery, not at all. It confirms it. The great scholastic at the end of the Middle Ages, John Mayer, a Scot, justified the enslaving of the Indians of the New World on the Aristotelian grounds that these people were natural slaves, following very much a Thomistic argument. Where does hostility to slavery arise? Categorical objections to slavery, i.e. the statement that it is wrong, it is always wrong, it can never be right, came with the validation of this world and life within this world, and that, as we know, is in large part the work of the apocalypse. Life is not a veil of tears, and if that's the case, then slavery cannot be a legitimate form for man. Men are redeemed through history, and if they are, slavery is unacceptable. That man is redeemed through history and through the apocalypse is where we begin to find people saying for the first time that slavery is radically illegitimate. The anti-slavery movement in the West begins in the late 17th century. It begins with radical Protestantism. It begins with the Quakers. That is, it arose in the wake, although not during, the English Revolution. Anti-slavery, by the mid-17th century, was a full-blown movement. You could really recognize an organization that wanted to end it. In that sense, the movement for abolition, the movement against slavery, predates any secular movement against slavery by at least one generation. The Enlightenment movement against slavery as incompatible with the rights of man, the Condorcet is implacably hostile to slavery, but he only comes later. It is with the apocalypse and with religious radicals that slavery is first really objected to and that a movement to abolish it is in fact set up. Figures like Price and Priestley would also be implacably hostile to slavery. And it's true to say that the rights of man held much more conviction and urgency when linked to the apocalypse. Moreover, for many, opposition to slavery was one of the signs that the millennial age was at hand. We can find any number of American preachers in the very early 19th century, first and second decades, saying that the end of slavery will bring the millennium. The Reverend Samuel Hopkins went on at great length to say there is reason to conclude that this light and conviction and these exertions will continue and increase till the slave traders shall be utterly destroyed, and then the gospel shall be preached to all nations. All men will be united in one family and kingdom under Christ the Savior. In a word, slavery is dying because the kingdom is hastening among men. Slavery didn't sit well with the apocalypse. Now, why was slavery wrong? All kinds of reasons you would think of. The opposition to slavery is fundamentally a moral opposition. And this, of course, reached deeply into American consciousness and American public culture. To be subject to another is to qualify one's capacity as a moral being. And there is no more severe subjection to another person than to be his slave. Thus, to be human, to be able to be moral, to be able to exert yourself as a moral being, required that you be free. To make decisions, to be responsible for yourself, was incompatible with the state of being a slave. And there could be no further degradation, therefore, than slavery. But if we say to be independent enables us to be moral and thus fully human and is thus what we ought to be and are designed to be, we would go further in America and say moral capacity is linked to civic capacity. Politics and salvation were always closely linked in American thinking, and slavery, therefore, not only corrupted people, it corrupted society. It was the great political corruption in the Redeemer nation. How to react to slavery? What to do about it? Well, William Lloyd Garrison, one of the early abolitionists, had such a moral reaction to it. He was so acutely conscious of slavery's moral contamination in the body politic, in the way I've just described it, the way it was so incompatible with society that America, he thought, had condemned itself by allowing such an institution to continue. The northern states, said Garrison, should secede from the South. We cannot be linked with the slave states. In the end, Garrison believed that the federal government had sold out America's mission, had compacted with Satan, and that the point was to withdraw from a society that had effectively damned itself. It was not altogether unlike the sectarianism that emerged with the failure of the English Revolution, where the Quakers withdrew into conventicles rather than trying to change the larger society of which they were a part. The problem with Garrison's perspective is simply this: it won't free anybody. It will simply allow you to live in an environment that is acceptably moral. Other people, of course, felt differently. Slavery was the great trial of the nation's status, all kinds of Americans increasingly believed, particularly after mid-century. Large sections of the Protestant establishment became convinced that this was the issue on which the nation and its purposes would be judged. This was the failure of the Redeemer nation. The end of slavery would realize America's purposes. Thus, for many, not mainstream, but for many, many people in America, the end of slavery would literally bring the millennium. This sort of thinking galvanized the immediate run-up to the Civil War. It is from this perspective that we need to read Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin and understand its intense, uncompromising moralism. That issue is a war for all humanity. Now, it is true that the war began as a war to preserve the Union, but the issue of slavery is what really underwrites it, and as wars tend to generate their own motives for being fought as they're being fought, the war very soon became a crusade against slavery, because this had really underwritten the fundamental issue between North and South. The war, it was said, should not be categorized with other instances of domestic and international hostility. Rather, the American Civil War was a crisis in the world's history. On the struggle to eliminate slavery hinged and this is their words, the destiny of all nations. What happens in America, this rather obscure country, is going to change the fate of mankind. The flag of the United States, they claimed, belongs to the world. It is the ensign of all the oppressed of all lands. The soil we tread, it is not yours. It is not mine. It belongs not to the cotton lords of the South, nor to the merchant princes of the North. It belongs to the constitutional government, and it belongs to human happiness. The test for mankind occurred here. The Civil War became, for all kinds of Northern American Protestants, the real Armageddon. We can remember this in Lincoln's words. You know these words every bit as I do. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether this nation, or any nation, so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. Now, frankly, on the face of it, this statement is purely absurd. Why in the world should an internecine war in a second-rate country, a Bush League nation, taking place in Obscuresville, Pennsylvania, be a test for the whole of mankind? This is a statement about America's purposes that truly, Americans could understand with greater feeling than other nations. It only makes sense. It only makes sense within the apocalyptic context through which so much of American Northern Protestantism saw the war. The vocabulary of the Redeemer Nation was the vocabulary of Abraham Lincoln. Let's take another piece of literature, not the one of the three that I listed, but one that I'm willing to bet a whole lot you know. Let's look at a song written by Julia Ward Howe, written 1 year before the Gettysburg Address. It is, of course, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It is arguably the best-known hymn in the United States, and it was sung right after Gettysburg when the first news that came out was that the North had lost that one, and this was a way to build up morale. It begins, you will remember, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Well, that's the coming of righteousness. But when we talk about the coming of the Lord, what are we talking about? This song is a kind of verse rendition of what? The book of Revelation. This is John of Patmos translated into American political rhetoric. The coming of the Lord isn't just the coming of righteousness. It's the last judgment. It's the millennium he's talking about. And the Lord, he's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. This is, of course, from Revelation 14:19. The reaping of the earth, the angel like the Son of the Man going through with his sickle, cutting down the grapes. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. My goodness, this is from Revelation 19, the rider on the white horse, out of whose mouth comes the sword to strike down the unrighteous and to protect righteousness. Mrs. Howe was not a radical sectarian Protestant. She was very mainstream. Think of the next verse. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flickering lamps. Now she's talking about the Army of the Potomac gathered at night with the campfires, right? But the image that she wants to tell us is the camp of the saints in the latter days. This, again, is from the Revelation, the compassed camp, as John calls it. She goes on to talk about, well, the third verse. Every one of these is apocalyptic. I have read the fiery gospel written in burnished rows of steel, that is to say, with guns. As ye with my contemners, so my grace you will have to deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel, since God goes marching on. This is Christ wounding the beast. This is what the army is about. This is the righteousness of the Union cause. And that righteousness, like all crusades, are for Americans apocalyptic. He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never sound retreat. He's sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh my goodness, this is the last judgment. And finally, in the last verse she says, in the beauty of the lilies Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. That is to say, receiving saving grace. It's the conversion experience. And then she has the line, as he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on. Now that line, while he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, I submit to you that Oliver Cromwell, Gerard Winstanley, James Harrington, and the Levellers would completely have understood what she was meaning. This is their voice. This is the voice of the English Revolution. Where there would be a difference, I submit, is this. For the people of the mid-17th century, as he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, the process for them was much more closely associated. Christ will make us holy in the very act of liberating mankind as Christ wells up from within. Even then, as Christ transfigures you and me, according to Mrs. Howe, so Winstanley spoke of the Spirit rising up within us. This is the language of the English Revolution. Were there anybody who disagreed with this? Were there any people who said no? Well, in fact, we can find some. Henry J. Van Dyke, a Presbyterian minister, said, this is nonsense. And he said it in 1864, when there were very few people saying this kind of thing. Let's hear what the Presbyterian minister who rejected this notion had to say. He said, I do not believe, but reject as blasphemous the sentiment so often uttered, even by Christian ministers, that God cannot do without the United States, that the Church of Christ is in any wise identified or dependent on the national existence. Whether it is God's inscrutable purpose to dash this nation to pieces or not, the foundations of His Church are secure. Now, where was Van Dyke politically? He had refused to see America as the Redeemer Nation. He had gone against all of that rhetoric that I have just shared with you. But the consequences of doing it were momentous. Van Dyke wanted to compromise with slavery. He did not regard the war as legitimate. His was the voice of conservative reaction. And it was difficult indeed to support the war without also adopting the images of apocalyptic transformation. There would be, right after the war, in the immediate wake, the period of Reconstruction, as you know, and this led to a second revolution, or almost a second revolution. In 1865, America stood on the verge of a second revolution. The end of slavery brought expectations about what? Radical democracy. Far-reaching reform in a whole range of directions. A reformulated federalism that might abolish the old state structures altogether, which were seen as kind of fiefdoms and feudal structures, reminiscent of a gone age that should have disappeared with the American Revolution itself. Truly a new era, truly an era of social justice. The fulfillment of prophecy was at hand. And yet the Reconstruction failed, as we all know. It failed in part because of apocalypticism. And this is its great irony. The apocalypse steeled men's nerves at a most difficult time. When the Union armies marched off to war, they ran into what? Defeat, followed by disaster, followed by catastrophe. To keep an army in the field took a level of commitment, and the apocalypse was essential to making that work. Those images were quite powerful. But the apocalypse did not provide a clear image of what to do. It was the same argument at the Putney debates when the Levellers proposed this basically democratic constitution. And Cromwell said, I can see we're at a great moment, but I can't see how your constitution comes from the book of Revelation. Americans have never dealt well with social class, neither in their apocalypticism nor in their republican ideology with which it's so closely associated. The problem was the great plantations did not go with the wind, as the novel tells us. There was talk about confiscation. There was talk about restructuring the basis of society. But the planter aristocracy survived, and it became impossible for blacks to do other than become sharecroppers for their former masters. Freedmen bureaus, supported by a dwindling number of federal troops, did not change things. And in fact, the coming of Protestant ministers into the South, Northern Protestant ministers into the South, did not change people's attitudes. There was, after all, a Confederate Israel as well, although it had none of that same moral power. Northerners had underestimated the power of racist ideology reinforced by Southern evangelicalism. And Northerners had failed to think in class terms. We want citizens. We want citizens and saints. And they didn't talk about radical redistribution of property and power. And that is why the Second Revolution in the United States did not, in fact, come off. It is a curious phenomenon, nevertheless. It is true of the South and of the North. Attitudes towards the Jews, even in the South in the early period and in the North, was quite extraordinary. For people who want to think in apocalyptic terms, there's a need for a Jewish community. Jews should be present in the working out of the Christian apocalypse. We've seen this again and again. Ideally, they should convert. But they don't even need to convert. That will happen at some point over the horizon. What you need to do is have a Jewish community to be part of your community. One of the most extraordinary examples of this, I love it, hopefully you will as well, a Jewish fellow by the name of Mordecai Noah in the early 19th century, it's in the first decade of the 19th century, goes to the town council of Buffalo, New York. And he says, we need a homeland for the Jews, and we should have it here in Buffalo. And the town council said that is a grand idea. And so he arranged, I think it was actually given to him, Grand Island in the lake, not far from Buffalo. This was going to be the new Israel. And he was going, he was very Jewish, he was well connected, he goes off to Europe. And bad luck for him, the Jewish community then was negotiating with Napoleon, a man of somewhat greater stature than the city council of Buffalo, the first Jewish Sanhedrin since really antiquity. And they said, Mordecai, go back, we'll talk to you later. No Jewish Israel in Buffalo. Nevertheless, this is symptomatic of a larger kind of phenomenon that really does take place. Even in the South, which after all is evangelical, there was a concern that Jews should be a part of the community. We didn't want the Jews to convert. Well, at least not right away. I mean, come the end of days, of course they would. But there was a possibility that there was Jewish wisdom that we didn't have as well, said the Christians. They wanted Jews, but they wanted real Jews. What's a real Jew? Don't ask a Jew about that. That will lead to nothing but trouble. They wanted people who lived by the book. They wanted Jews who kept kosher. If you want to get respect from your Christian neighbors, you've got to be a real Jew. Not some liberal Disraeli, not some sort of modern politician. The concern goes back to Cromwell. It is very much a part of the English-speaking world. But respect, honor of your Christian neighbors meant that you had to observe Yom Kippur. What can we say? The Jews were not the killers of Christ. They only became the killers of Christ for the South, and particularly in the South, although this would be true of the North as well, in the late 19th century. As ideas of nation become increasingly racialized through social Darwinism, having nothing to do with Charles Darwin, by the way, increasingly a range of racial stereotypes are developed. It also is connected with mass migration of Jewish people from Eastern Europe. Jews from Germany were remarkably like middle-class Americans. Maybe the Jews really were the agents of Antichrist. The experience of the Jews in the late 19th century changes very quickly. Increasingly, they become the enemy. Increasingly, they are the enemy in our midst. We begin to find the treatment of the Jews, particularly in the South, although not exclusively in the South, following the lines of that of the freed Negroes. There will be assaults, there will be beatings, there will be lynchings. And the most famous instance of this is Leo Frank in Atlanta in 1915. In our own time, there are virulent anti-Semitic eschatologies, most outstandingly the Christian Identity Movement. As in Europe, the apocalypse could lead to toleration, and it could lead to intolerance as well. Let's look quickly at the 1960s. The 1960s, in many ways, is the successor to the Reconstruction. It is the next most radical moment. America had become, in the 19th century, a secular culture, and by the 20th century, there certainly couldn't be any argument about it. Whatever America's redeeming mission might be, Americans in the later 20th century saw pluralism and secularism as the basis by which they could share common values. There were so many different religions and so many different ideas. And yet, the voice of the radical apocalypse is still with us. The year? 1967. The place? Marks, Mississippi. Let me hasten to say that's spelled M-A-R-K-S. It's not the radical, okay? It's a poor black community. The event? Jesse Jackson is organizing the Poor People's March on Washington. Jackson is addressing a poor black church. It's filled to capacity. He speaks with, as he does today for that matter, with an extended biblical metaphor. He says, "We will go to Washington and there will be the police. There will be this blue line. This will be like the Red Sea. And like the Red Sea, it will part. And we will pass through to Washington." And as this extraordinary metaphor builds and builds, a woman in the back begins to speak in tongues, has a conversion experience, rolls on the ground, goes through the whole ecstatic experience. Now, this was a purely political speech. But for the poor black sharecropper, she understood secular reality through the lenses of the Bible. This presented a problem for Walter Cronkite, who was doing the news. He did not know quite what to make of this. He was all in favor of it. He thought it was a good thing, but there she was sort of rolling around on the ground. Jackson was speaking in two registers, one powerfully attractive to middle-class Americans, both black and white, and attractive to Walter Cronkite. The other was the ancient religious voice, going back to the 16th and 17th century, with its roots 2,000 years earlier. And that was the voice that spoke to the congregation. Let's take one more example of this. 4 years earlier, 1963, the place is Washington, D.C. It's the Civil Rights March for the Civil Rights Bill of the next year. Martin Luther King gives his "I Have a Dream" speech. For most middle-class Americans, black and white, King's dream was the American dream. The dream of equal opportunity and social justice, the fact that you're not judged by your race, you're judged by the content of your character, and everyone should have an equal opportunity in this society. Now, King endorsed all of these things, to be sure, but that was not the dream he was speaking of. Martin Luther King was talking about Nebuchadnezzar's dream out of Daniel 2. It was a dream, as Daniel had explained to the king, which outlined through symbols the course of world history, from Babylon to the final days, a series of empires pictured as part of this great human figure, this great statue. At the top, made of gold, was Babylon, the contemporary world. Then there was a breast and arms of silver, then belly and thighs of bronze, then legs of iron and toes of iron and clay. And it would be broken to bits by a stone, cut out by no human hand, with the destruction of the last empire, and with it the whole edifice would arise the latter days of the kingdom of God, a kingdom which would last forever. As it says in Daniel, the stone that struck the image became itself a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And that's what King is saying. As King said, with this faith, we will hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. And that stone would manifest itself as freedom throughout the nation. It would grow into a great mountain. And as he says, let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California, from the Stone Mountain of Georgia, from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside, let freedom ring. This is the book of Daniel that he's talking about. He uses other apocalyptic image as well. It is the little stone coming from faith that builds the great mountain of the just society. This is the meaning of Martin Luther King's speech. Like Jesse Jackson, King spoke in a dual register. Like Jesse Jackson, he would be understood, I submit to you, by the levelers and the diggers 300 years earlier. The battle hymn of the Republic and all these images were very much a part of his world as it was their world. Let me suggest this. This is going to be a little bit heretical, but after all, if we do the apocalypse, we're bound to have heresy. Heresy comes with the apocalypse. That's part of its attractiveness. If we want to understand Martin Luther King, if we want to understand Black America, we will do far better to look to the traditions of the levelers and the diggers and the English Revolution than to putative African survivals. These people speak with a voice of England 300 years ago. And although those people were white, that voice is in fact the same. Let me mention just quickly the age of Aquarius, which also came with the 60s. Many Americans were no longer familiar with biblical sources. That is true today. That's why I teach Bible lessons in class, of all things. Many middle-class Americans in the 1960s were highly suspicious of clerical claims and the texts from which these images had arisen. Nevertheless, secular neo-pagan versions had arisen, and students get into neo-Druidism, neo-Celtic, and neo-Norse mythology, and they give it this curious apocalyptic character. New Age thinking retained the linear character of Western thought. Its emphasis on non-Christian symbols gave it a non-parochial and universal patina, very much in keeping with the expectations of the age in the 60s. We were talking universality. What was the slogan in Europe in the 1960s of the student movement? We shall fight, we shall win, Paris, London, Rome, Berlin. It underscored the perception that democratization was a universal undertaking. What happened in Warsaw was immediately relevant, it was thought, to what happened in San Francisco. The struggles of the 60s would set right the unredeemed promise of all political revolutions: human equality, political democracy, civil liberty. Unlike the 1860s, in the 1960s, America's voice truly did speak to Europe. The radicals of Europe went back and forth and could change vocabularies with remarkable ease. American apocalyptic imagery, particularly paganized as it was, seemed to speak to Europeans with remarkable cogency, and it was easy. It was easy for me to be active in Paris, in London, in Edinburgh, as well as Chicago. And that's why the hapless Bill Clinton found it no problem in London either. There was a common movement. It was a European movement. Everyone could participate in it. And then there were disasters. There was a setback in Prague with the coming of the Russian troops. There was a setback in Paris with the coming of the CRS, the highway patrol, which is really the political police, with De Gaulle restored. There was a setback in London when Ted Heath swept to power, not a radical socialist power. There was a setback in Washington when conservatism came to power with Nixon. And there was the oil embargo of 1973, which led everyone to wonder, how in the world can any economy function as the price of oil quadruples? There was a shattered loss of confidence. And in that context, people turned to inner light and personal salvation. Salvation was not a political achievement. It was a personal discovery. People wanted to find themselves. There's a retreat from politics to consciousness and self-involvement. We go off to Vermont to find this little world where we can save and live by ourselves, because politics doesn't seem to work. There is the withdrawal that we see with the Quakers as the English Revolution crumbled before them. Let's end on this note. Why do people jog? Why do people become obsessed with health? Health becomes a real issue in the 1970s, and it's a real issue because what do you want to do? Health is a spiritual quest. It's a reintegration of body and soul. It's a private piety, not public politics. We go out to jog, not to get in shape. Jogging's dangerous. You'll ruin your knees. We go out to jog to reintegrate body and soul, to find holistic running. We go out to jog to find our spiritual self when the spirituality inherent in politics has no longer been persuasive. When we have failed in politics, we become self-absorbed in personal transcendence.